Okay, the first thing is that the midterms will be given back at the end of the class today. This is Matt Gottfried. He's the reader. So at the end of the class, we'll. I don't know what's the matter with the. Still quite loud. At the end of the class, the exams will be handed back, going from A on your left straight through to Z. I'm sorry, what? And you'll notice inside the exam, just on the inside cover, there'll be a number grade. There's a concordance table on the course website that tells you how to convert your number grade into a letter grade. So that's the first thing you should look up when you get home. If you have questions about the grading of the exam, the first person you should see is the person who actually did the grading. They,
I don't imagine you'll have any problems with how I graded them, but in case you do, I'm going to have office hours on Wednesday from 1 until 3, and my office is bunch 3385.
Okay. Plus, he has. You can get in touch with him via email, and his name and email address are at the bottom of the concordance table, which is on the home page of the course website. All right. Before you go to see him, however, you should do your own research to see what the correct answers are. You know, if it means listening to that lecture again, or where the point was covered, or doing the appropriate reading. You should make a real effort to figure out what the answers are. Now, the most of the actual exam questions are still in the blue books that you handed in, so you'll be able to see what the exam questions are. For some reason, if your exam questions got lost, you can see me and I can give you another copy of the exam. Okay. If after talking with Matt, you still have problems with the grading, right? And he has the power to change the number grades. If you still have problems, then you should see me. But don't see me until you've done those two things first. Figured out what the right answer is, you know, done all the work that you should do, and then see him to kind of talk about it. Now, the class today, in order to give you time to kind of pick up the exams, and given the fact there's another class coming in at 11 o'clock, we have to get out a little early, so I'll try and end the lecture 5 or 10 minutes early, so you'll have plenty of time to get the exams. As I say, they'll all be in alphabetical order. You know, it'll be like A to C, and a D to F, and so on, all the way to Z on the side of the room. Okay, anyone have any questions about the grade, you know, any of these kind of technical things, any points you want to raise? No? All right, today we're going to talk about the 1948-49 period. Remember how I kind of ended the lecture last time? I was talking about the security dilemma. How many of you kind of were exposed to that concept in other classes? Well over half. It's a particularly important notion in contemporary international relations thought. As a matter of fact, the most important article on the security dilemma. Let's see, maybe it's this one. Maybe this is better, I think. Okay. The most important article on the security dilemma was written by Robert Jervis in this very building when Jervis was an assistant professor in our department, the UCLA Department of Political Science. It was called Cooperation Under the Security Dilemma. It came out in World Politics in, I think, 1979. A very important article because what's basically the point of the security dilemma, Jervis's point in this article? It's like, it's concerned with this great issue of how you can have war. And the claim is, basically, you can have a war even though no one really wants it. Why is that? Because given the nature of the international system, countries have to be concerned with their security. And in providing for their security, they have to take actions which would threaten the security of other countries, of rival powers. The more we build up our position, the more that's a threat to other countries. And other countries are going to react accordingly and take measures which we feel threaten us. Right? And even if we know what's going on, even if we understand what's going on, it's still a dilemma for us whether to move in this position, in this direction, because on the one hand, we have to concern ourselves with our security and therefore with our position in the world. On the other hand, you don't really want to threaten the other guy because his reaction might be unpleasant for you. And this is a dilemma. You want to reassure them that your goals are not aggressive, but you're taking all these actions to build up your military power, and a rival country is not going to be too easily convinced that it has nothing to worry about. So this problem, the security dilemma problem, the whole idea that countries take actions which are kind of perceived as aggressive or as threatening in one way or another for purely defensive reasons, the idea is that this lies at the heart of the international political system. This is why under anarchy, which is to say in a system, in a regime where there's no overarching authority to just kind of lay down the law, why there's this real problem, why the anarchic structure of international politics, where countries have to do whatever they need to do to provide for their own security, regardless of consequence, why the anarchic structure of the international system pushes states into conflicts with each other. Right? Very important concept, because it bears on this whole notion of what makes for war. You don't need an aggressor to have a war. A war can result from the workings of the security dilemma, according to the theory. And as always, you can't just say, oh, well, here's a nice, clever international relations theory. It must be true. You're using the theory as a lens for understanding the real world. It's like, how much does this stuff really count for in the real world? Isn't it true that you look at all these big conflicts, they're, 20th century, that there are powers that you could legitimately call aggressive, and that if countries aren't really aggressive, they'll be able to kind of work things out, Maybe you have this notion of the security dilemma, but how much does it count for in the real world? How much emphasis should we place on this concept? Okay? There's only one way of answering that question, right? One and only one way to kind of get at that issue. And that's by looking at the historical evidence through the lens of that theory. Right? Can you think of any historical examples, major historical examples, where the security dilemma mechanism played a central role? Where you have a conflict resulting from the clash of two essentially defensive strategies on both sides? And the answer to that question is yes. And the main case in point is the Cold War. That's one of the reasons the Cold War is of such interest, it's this example that demonstrates to you the power of international relations thinking, of the kind of thinking embodied in the Jervis Security Dilemma article. Why is that? Because if you look at the ordinary historical debates about the origins of the Cold War, right? They replicate the political debates you find in the culture as a whole. Left versus right. The right wing has a nice, neat theory of the Cold War. For them, it's like Soviet aggressiveness. United States, Western democracies, these are peace-loving countries. They had no plan to threaten the Soviet Union. They were kind of quite happy to accept things as they were at the end of the war. It's only the fact that you are dealing with this expansionist, aggressive, communist regime that's determined to, you know, impose its ideology as far as its power reaches. That's the source of the problem. It has to do with the nature of the Soviet regime. Well, that's the right-wing interpretation. And then the left has its own interpretation. You know, the right-wing interpretation was the consensus interpretation in the United States. And for most of the early Cold War period itself, certainly in the 1950s, well into the 1960s, but with the Vietnam War and the discrediting of so many of the assumptions that lay at the heart of U.S. Policy and culture as a whole, a very different view became fashionable, kind of the view of the revisionist historians about the Cold War. And this was the idea of Soviet Union is not an aggressive power. The Soviet Union has, you know, totally legitimate, totally understandable security interests on its borders. You can't blame them for being concerned about what's going on its periphery, given its history in the 20th century, right? And it's the problem lies with the Americans. They're the aggressive ones. Not just Vietnam, but all of American policy is aggressive. You know, we want to roll back Soviet power. We want to democratize Eastern Europe. We don't care about Soviet security interests. Right? It's all the Americans' fault. You know, these debates correspond to this whole notion that you want to understand the cause of a conflict. You basically, that boils down to figuring out who to blame, who to point the finger at. Right? And it's against that backdrop of these debates between orthodox historians and revisionist historians that you can understand the power of the security dilemma concept, right? That basically, people like Jervis were saying, it's not a question of who to blame. It's not a question of figuring out whether the Americans are to blame or whether the Russians are to blame. That's just a silly way of looking at it. Because what you have to understand is that both sides are pushed into adopting certain types of strategies because of the nature of the system that they find themselves in. It's the structure of the system that's responsible. Okay? It's a systemic interpretation, a structural interpretation. And you recall, these issues, like, they run like a thread through our analysis this quarter. You know, when we're talking about the Taylor book. Very similar to the sort of distinction Taylor made on page 24 of that book. You know, the basic problem was political and not moral. It's not a question of evil regimes pursuing aggressive policies. It's a question of the sorts of policies you could expect given power political realities. Right? Important issue. And the Jervis interpretation, security dilemma interpretation, says that applies with particular force to the Cold War. And the thrust of what I was arguing the past couple of lectures is that, yeah, that's correct. Yes, you could see the security dilemma mechanism in operation here. That's the key to understanding the origins of the Cold War. Origins of the Cold War, you know, it's like it's a puzzle. Why is it a puzzle? Because both sides presumably are willing to live with the status quo of a divided Europe. You know, they might not like it, it might not be their optimal solution, but political realities, military realities, power realities are such that accepting the status quo of a divided Europe is so vastly preferable to a war that everyone is pretty much locked into the status quo. That's what you would think, and so when you do have this conflict, it's kind of puzzling. How is it to be understood? We kind of started having to reach into domestic politics to kind of... I'll just wait for those two guys to finish their conversation. Okay? All right. The right? We reached into the domestic politics. The U.S. government felt it had to kind of mobilize opinion at home so as to mobilize American power to provide an effective counterweight to Soviet power in Europe. And that the division of Europe in itself did not lead directly to a stable peace. There's another way of looking at this whole issue, and this is to say, as a general rule, the division of Europe was a source of stability. A lot of people said, oh no, the Cold War was caused by the division of Europe. Not so. The division of Europe was a solution to the question of how the two sides could get along with each other. So if there were problems, they must have had to do with exceptions to that general rule about how the two sides could coexist. Right? The general rule is, you do whatever you want in your part of Europe, and we'll do whatever we want in our part of Europe, and on the basis of that rule, we can get along. The Burns philosophy at Potsdam, so on. So if there was a problem, there had to be some exception to that rule. And there was one and only one exception to that rule. We were willing to accept Soviet domination of Eastern Europe, including Eastern Germany. Meaning of the Burns Plan, meaning of U.S. Policy at Potsdam. Burns made this clear over and over again. A month after Potsdam, the French Foreign Minister, Georges Bidault, comes over to Washington for talks with the Americans. The French had been excluded from Potsdam. And Burns was explaining American policy to Bidault. And basically, Bidault was saying, well, the kind of shift of the center of gravity of Germany to the west is threatening for France, because the center of gravity was shifting to the west because Germany was now just the Germany of the three western zones. And Burns looks at him and he basically says, are you kind of crazy? This is less threatening to you. A Germany of 45 million, which is the population of the three western zones of Germany at that time, is a lot less threatening to you than a Germany of 65 million, which is the Germany that would include the eastern zone as well. Burns contemplates, foresees, a kind of a West German entity, a division of Germany between East and West. No question about it, right? The Americans are willing to accept this. They think that they've struck a deal with Stalin, a friendly division of Europe, an amicable divorce, right? And the Soviets, they were willing to allow the Americans and America's friends a free hand on their side of the line of demarcation in Europe. They keep the communists in Italy and in France, huge communist parties in the post-war period, in a short leash. They make it clear that they're expected not to engage in revolutionary activity. Same sort of thing with Greece. The Stalin notion is a spheres of influence notion. We can accept that. With one big exception, right? And what does that exception have to do with? The western part of Germany. Soviets insist on total control over eastern Germany, right? But they don't want to give the western powers a totally free hand to do whatever they want in West Germany. And in particular, they're very sensitive to anything that points to West Germany being, you know, organized, you know, not just without the Soviets, which they could more or less accept, but against them. To anything that mobilizes the West Germans by pointing to the Soviets and telling them that the Soviet Union is the great enemy of German national goals. Oh, we believe in a unitary German state. Point to the official Potsdam Protocol. The Soviets reneged on their promises. They're not willing to do that because no one knew what the real story was in those days because all these Potsdam documents were still secret. Okay? So you have this story. 1945, the hope is friendly division of Europe. But that doesn't work. Why does it not work? What triggers the Cold War? It's these crises in Russia's south. The crises of the Turkish Straits, the crisis of the whole question of the Soviet withdrawal from the areas that it occupied in Iran. The Iranian and Turkish crisis of 1946 trigger this change, even though the Soviets give away in both cases, you know. They pull their troops out of Iran. They lay off Turkey because they find out through their spies in Washington that just how far Truman was willing to go at the point of war. So those crises are removed from the equation. But they had effected a change in basic American thinking. The Americans now understand that it's crucial for them to mobilize their power. That a friendly division of Europe is no longer viable because the Soviet policy is so sensitive to power realities. And if they see weakness on their periphery, then they're going to be tempted to move ahead. So the only way of keeping Soviet power at bay is by mobilizing American power. That means mobilizing American opinion and getting the American public to accept the idea that if push comes to shove, U.S. power will be thrown into the balance and force will be used in order to keep the Soviets in line. Right? And to do that, you have to over-define the threat. This is the famous a phrase of Dean Acheson, 1946 Undersecretary of State, from 1949 to 1953 U.S. Secretary of State, very important person in this whole story. Acheson referred subsequently to the need to make things clearer than the truth. The same sort of argument we saw about Kennan, same sort of point that came up when we talked about 1941. The American people can't be expected to act like grown-ups and think in power political terms. Right? They are not willing to go to war for purely political reasons. The moral issues have to be, you know, thrown into the center of the stage and, in fact, over-defined in order to get the American people to do what they should be doing. And it's very clear from the sources relating to 1946 and 1947 that this was a conscious calculation on the part of the U.S. foreign policy-making elite. Right? So the U.S. domestic public is one big target. The other big target are the Germans. Because how can you get the Germans to become part of the West, to kind of join their power to the power of the West as a whole? And the answer is, you got to play up to them. You got to say, well, if you side with the West, then we'll kind of ease up on all the controls. And you can ease up on the controls in a Cold War context, because with the Soviet threat right in the heart of pre-war Germany there, the western zones of Germany are dependent on the western powers for protection. Right? And if they're dependent on western powers for protection, you have a lot of influence over them, and you don't have to rely on these artificial controls. So you can ease up and transform the political status of Germany. But to do this, you have to frame the issue to the Germans as the Soviets. They're your real enemy. Especially since the basic strategy that the U.S. government opts for, beginning in 1945, is a strategy that's premised on the idea that Germany is going to be divided indefinitely. If Western Germany becomes part of the Western Bloc, the Soviets aren't just going to hand over East Germany on a silver platter so that stronger German state would become an even stronger component of the anti-Soviet Western Bloc. As long as you have a division of Europe between blocs, and in fact between hostile blocs, Germany is going to remain divided. So we certainly wouldn't want to hand over Western Germany to the Soviet side. The same logic applies to them. Why should they want to do it? Right? So the Western strategy implied to the Germans that they'd have to accept indefinitely the division of their own country, that they'd have to give up, basically, on their number one national goal. Any chance of their achieving their national goal would depend on them not aligning themselves with the West and adopting some sort of a neutralist formula, staying outside the two blocks. But this, no way do we want this, partly because it would mean that this neutral Germany would be too vulnerable to pressure from the East if it's not supported by American power. partly because it would mean that we would no longer have enough control over German policy, because Germany is still viewed as inherently a very strong country, and therefore therefore a threat. So we, meaning the United States, Britain, and France, are much more inclined to a solution based on a divided Germany. Germans aren't going to like that. So how do you square that circle? Well, you just have to kind of hit on this point about it's not our fault that Germany's divided. It's really the Soviets' fault. They're intent on extending their power. They want to kind of, you know, they've determined to communize Eastern Germany. If they had their way, they'd communize all of Germany. Right? So you have this dynamic setting. How does it relate to all this security dilemma business? This strategy that the Western powers are pursuing is called the Western strategy for Germany. Right? Let me stress this point again because I think it's a very important point. It's the kind of thing you're going to be examined on in the final exam. Hint, hint. Western strategy for Germany. People look back at what America's grand strategy was after World War II. And there's all this talk about the strategy of containment. And George Kennan, the architect of the strategy of containment, wrote an important article in Foreign Affairs in 1947 under the pseudonym of X. So this is called the X article, which he laid out the strategy of containment. Right? It's not nearly as important as people think. In fact, it's of trivial importance. And indeed, the whole notion of containment, there's nothing special to it. It's like we paid the blood price to be where we were at the end of World War II, you know, to control Europe west of the line of demarcation, to be there in Western Germany. After having, you know, destroyed the Hitler regime, we're not going to turn over all Western Europe with its vast resources to the Soviet Union. Right. Of course we're not going to do that. People say, oh, well, the Americans intended to withdraw after World War II. Not quite true. Not quite true. And in particular, by the time of Potsdam, the assumption was that we were going to be there. American power is going to be committed. So why would it be committed? Because we have troops there. There are occupation troops. There aren't that many of them. But as long as there are any troops there, they'll serve as a tripwire in the event the Soviets move west. What's very revealing about Potsdam is that it was decided not to create a German government there. In other words, not to restore their political rights to the Germans, certainly for the immediate future. No decision to create a German government. Well, if no German government is there, that means the occupying army stays. The military government remains intact. So the troops remain there. As long as the troops remain there, well, that serves as a tripwire against enemy attack and therefore commits American power to the maintenance of the status quo in Germany. Right? Containment is kind of an obvious reflexive strategy. It doesn't take too much brains to say, we're not going to turn over all this area, these areas that we occupy, to a hostile power, even to a rival power. What was important, what was unexpected, what was a significant departure was what was called the Western strategy for Germany. What does that mean, the Western strategy for Germany? It means that Western Germany, the three Western zones, right? The British zone in the north, the American zone in the south, and the little French zone in the southwest. These three Western zones would be organized first economically, then politically, and ultimately militarily under the auspices of the three Western powers, that they would be tied to the Western world in all kinds of different ways, economically, culturally, politically, and the final analysis, militarily. Right? Integrated into the Western world in general, integrated into Western Europe in particular. Because all these notions of European integration, European unification, and so on, meaning continental West European integration, These ideas take hold during this period, and the whole German question lies at the heart of the whole European integration business, as my friend Dave Andrews explained in a talk that he gave yesterday. Why does it lie at the heart of it? Because people are still worried about Germany. There are all these controls on Germany having to do with the occupation regime. You know that if you're going to win the Germans over to your side, you're going to have ease up on those controls. But you still don't want Germany to be totally free to develop her power. So how can you limit German power without discriminating against Germany? By having these structures apply not just to the Germans, but to the other powers in Europe, and in particular to the French and the Benelux countries, all at the same time. So they wouldn't discriminate against Germany, but still German power will be kept out. And if you succeed in this goal of transforming the whole political setup in Western Europe, making Western Europe into a unified, integrated, you know, block of powers, well, you achieve a number of things. For one thing, you give the Germans something to hope for, something to aspire to that could substitute for the traditional pursuit of German national goals. If you're telling the Germans, give up on unification, well then, it helps if you could say, but we have this European project that can become the focus of your energies, and all of whatever idealism you have can be focused on building Europe. And building Europe also means Western Europe can stand on its own two feet. It can defend itself. It can build up its power without allowing Germany as such to become too strong. It can build up its power and serve to balance Soviet power in Europe all by itself so that the Americans don't have to be involved in Europe all that much. Right? The Americans don't like the idea of a permanent military commitment in Europe. The notion from the very start is the Europeans have the resources, they have the skills, in theory they can build up enough power to balance the Soviets without direct American support. The Europeans can do that. And when they do it, then the Americans can pull out. We're not cut out to be a great imperial power. We don't want to transform Europe into, you know, the main province in the American global empire. It's like we're not good at it. Right? This is kind of the assumption in this period. Okay. So the Americans are pursuing this policy, the Western strategy for Germany, with British and French support. It starts in 1945. It's implicit in what Burns was doing at Potsdam. 46, there's this big change. It becomes much more militarized because now, after seeing what happened with Turkey and Iran, the Americans understand a friendly division of Europe is not going to work. We have to mobilize our power and throw power into the balance. And so there's this kind of hardening of American policy in 1946. And in particular, the Americans are kind of playing up to the Germans. The Soviets respond in kind. There's a competition for German favor at the end of 1946, culminating in Burns' Stuttgart speech that I talked about. And you had all these events, the reparation stop in the spring, followed by the decision to create the buy zone in July, and so on. It's clear that we're embarked upon the course of the Western strategy. Not with the goal of deliberately posing a threat to the Soviets. That's an unwanted byproduct, but there's no way really of avoiding it. And it does pose a threat to the Russians, because the West Germans are being told, as part of all this business, if they want to figure out what's standing in the way of their national goals of a reunified German state, it's all the Soviets' fault. We're pulling in the Germans, building up the power of the Western system for essentially defensive purposes. But the Soviets are bound to feel that this is a threat. And they're bound to react in kind. Security dilemma. Again, Soviet policy is also to be understood in defensive terms. They're concerned very much about what's happening in Western Germany. A strong West German state, a state that's able to build up its power to whatever level it chooses, this will necessarily pose a threat to the Soviets at the end of the road. Right? If that's the case, you want to nip it in the bud. Right? Soviets feel like the blood price that they paid in the Second World War gives them a right to have some influence, not total influence, but some influence over the course of events in Germany, and in particular in West Germany. Right? So in 1946, it seems that things are heading toward a conflict. This is the central engine that's driving the Cold War, the German question. 1947, there's a bit of a change. Burns is out, fired by Truman, not because of any real difference of her policy, but because Burns he didn't treat Truman with enough personal respect. Yeah. He's replaced by General Marshall, George Marshall. And Marshall doesn't like this stuff at all. He says, well, yeah, for the time being, the American people are all up in arms. That's not going to last indefinitely. And in the long run, if we want a peaceful world, a stable world, we have to find some way of living with the Soviets. We have to really try and reach some accommodation. And that's the whole thrust of the Marshall policy in the first half of 1947. He goes over to Moscow in the spring, spends like 6 weeks over there trying to work things out with Stalin. But when you think about it, what sort of solution would have been viable? A neutral Germany? Well, no one kind of really wants that. If it's weak, it's a kind of a power vacuum, too vulnerable to outside pressure from the East especially. If it's strong, then you're off and running with what you had after 1919, playing off the East and West against each other, building up its power, the whole Stresemann business all over again. There's no obvious solution to the question of how to build a unified German state. And so the Moscow conference fails. And the Americans kind of fall back on this whole notion of, well, if we're not going to solve these problems on an all-European or all-German basis, at least let's solve it on a Western basis. So that's what you find happening. The Marshall Plan in the middle of 1947, designed in such a way as to prevent the East Europeans from participating. The whole goal is to allow Western Europe to recover economically. And Germany is an integral part of that. This notion of, well, we have no choice but to allow the German economy to recover, to allow Germany to recover politically and set up some sort of government in Germany. Can't run Germany as a colony forever. If you want Germany to recover and throw its lot in with the West, you have to kind of move in that direction. And the Soviets see which way, you know, things are going. They become... Soviet policy becomes increasingly harsh, increasingly anti-Western because it senses that it's being threatened. This is the period of Zhdanovshchina, it's called in Russian, the notion that you have these two blocks in Europe implacably hostile to each other. Revolutionary strikes in France, all these disturbances in Italy with the Communist Party. The French communists are thrown out of the government. It seems that France is like practically on the verge of civil war. But the problem is managed. And at the end of 1947, you have this conference, the Conference of No Return, it's sometimes called, the London Conference of Foreign Ministers, December 47. This is when Marshall basically decides it's hopeless to try and reach a deal with the other side. We have no choice but to move ahead on a West-only basis in West Germany. Move ahead toward the creation of a West German state. Right? And so that's what happens in the beginning of 1948. Events move ahead on these three distinct but interrelated tracks. Number one, the process leading to the creation of the Federal Republic of Germany. and that the key decision is made at the beginning of June 1948 at another conference in London, something called the London Recommendations. The framework for the establishment of West German state is set up. Then the Soviet response to that, the Berlin blockade of late June, begins late June of 1948. And then the Western response to that, because it seems like there's a real risk of war. Berlin is being cut off, right? The whole process of moving ahead without the Soviets and West Germany, this might touch off a war. For the Europeans to cooperate with this, they have to have some sense of security, and the Americans move toward creating a security regime, an American military guarantee of Western Europe, to protect this whole process as it runs its course. And this is the process that leads to the signing of the North Atlantic Treaty, NATO, in April of 1949. Okay. What happens during this period is of fundamental importance. Why? Because this is the climax of this conflict. All these things have come to a head. The German question has come to a head. Right? The West has decided to take the plunge, and a West German state comes into being. Federal Republic of Germany is proclaimed in May of 1949. Right? That same month, the Soviets lift the Berlin blockade. Okay. Soviet goal is not to kick the Western powers out of Berlin. They wanted to do that. They would have managed the blockade in a totally different way. In particular, they would have jammed the radars that were needed to guide the Western planes coming in to deliver supplies to West Berlin through the airlifting. And realize West Berlin is this land island in the middle of the communist part of Germany. So it's very easy for the communists to exert pressure on the West by interfering with access to West Berlin. Okay, but they lay off the Berlin blockade. The same month that the Federal Republic of Germany is proclaimed, and a month after the North Atlantic Treaty was signed, this 1948-49 period, you'd think that this means that events have run their course. Right? Europe is now divided in a formal way. Because a few months later, the Soviets set up their own state in their part of Germany, the East German regime, communist regime, the German Democratic Republic, as it was called. Two German states. The West has its military organization, NATO. West is now a military bloc. Soviets respond a few years later by creating their equivalent. It's called the Warsaw Pact. Europe is divided formally. Germany is divided. The Berlin Block, this you'd say, well, this is the meaning of all this. The Soviets have decided to shelve all this stuff. They've abandoned the pressure on Berlin. Have we finally, therefore, reached an understanding, a stable international system? The answer there is no. Proof of that is the very next year, the world moves into a very sharp crisis. The crisis of the winter of 50-51, to my mind, that's the sharpest crisis of the Cold War, worse even than the Berlin and Cuban crises of 1961-62. Working closer to war. How did it happen? To understand how it happened is tantamount to trying to understand why it was that the system that seemed to be coming into being in 1949 did not provide the basis of a stable international order. So that is what I am going to begin talking about next Wednesday. Okay, so like I say, I'm going to put the exams over there.